Inside the Huddle with Sky Sports, Neil Reynolds and Jeff Rimbo.
Yes, hello and welcome to Inside the Huddle in association with NFL Shop Europe. We're sponsored by DraftKings.co.uk, your home of one-day fantasy sports. I'm your host, Neil Reynolds, joined as ever by my partner who's in the middle of training camp with the Hamilton Tiger Cats. It's definitely football season for Jeff Rimbo. Jeff, how are you doing, mate?
I'm doing great. You know what? We have done this thing from a lot of places. I mean, we've done it from Costa Rica. We've done it from Hawaii. We've done it from, you know, the, I guess, the, what do you say, the moon at the NFL UK offices. This is another unique venue as we take Inside the Huddle on the road. I am sitting in my car outside of our training camp facility, hoping that we get better audio. So we brought it to you from every possible venue, I think, now.
We have. There was a couple of times when I was at training camps where I was sitting in a car, and there was one time around one of the International Series games, I was sat in my car outside a fast food restaurant that shall remain nameless with golden arches.
I remember when you got lost.
I can't, you know, it's difficult. There's now without, you know, I'm not very good with modern technology and sat navs and stuff, Jeff. So listen, we're going to try and plow through this anyway. It's not going to be ideal, but we appreciate everyone sticking with us. And we know that Jeff's very busy at the moment with his schedules. We're going to do our state of the franchise and look at the Houston Texans, the Seattle Seahawks, and the Kansas City Chiefs. But let's get caught up on a little bit of news from around the NFL. The OTAs, the organized team activities, are continuing across America. And separate from that, our old friend Jeff, Christian Kirksey from NFL UK Live, has signed a four-year, $38 million deal with the Cleveland Browns. He's going to get $20 million guaranteed just for signing on the dotted line. He had 148 tackles, 2.5 sacks last year. The Browns have done what we've been telling the Browns to do for a number of years, and that's keeping good young talent in their building.
Absolutely. You know, and you know, you take the personal part of it out of it, because we had a chance to travel with him for 3 days around the UK doing our, you know, on the road segment, and you realize what a great kid he is. I mean, what a quality person he is. Now you, and I think this is really important to me. One of the challenges that the Browns have had is they've invested money in guys that are, you know, that are risky. You know, as Devon Best, and you know, you could go through their history. Now they're investing money in a guy who is a solid guy, who's a team guy, who not only is productive, but he's productive beyond the stat line. He's productive in practice. He's productive in meetings. He's productive in how he takes care of his wife, and that's money well spent.
And that's, I think, the key thing you've hit on there, Jeff, because They have swung and missed on a number of people. Just take the 2014 draft as an example. They took Johnny Manziel and Justin Gilbert. Both flamed out and didn't make it in Cleveland. They took Christian in the third round, and he's become a team leader already. And I think this is evidence that he believes in what the Browns are doing, because he could have played out this contract and either tested free agency or made them slap the franchise tag on him. But he signed up for the long haul earlier than he probably needed to. And it's interesting because you see the reaction in America. A lot of them were like, Christian who? But if you really watch the Browns, and like we talked with Christian about how much he played, you know, no defender in the NFL played more snaps last year than him. He's a tackling machine when you look at the numbers. As I said, 148 stops a year ago. He's clearly buying what they're selling.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a really good point, Neil, because, you know, when you look at this, it's beyond, we're not in this business of the business. We're not collecting trading cards. You know, this is a different kind of deal. So here's a young kid. The best thing you can do for your football team is be available. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and when I say that, what I'm talking about is, do you play every game? Are you there for your football team? He played more snaps than any defender in the National Football League. So, again, you talk about how you spend your money. Tough guy. Everybody gets hurt in the National Football League. Everybody plays in pain. But here's a kid that plays through things. And you know, it was interesting when we were on stage with him, Neil, and then not only on stage, because on stage you get a sense of the person. But when you spend the time that you and I did with him on those 3 days, you really get to know the person. And Christian was genuine when he would talk about how he felt the Browns were going in the right direction. Mm. And he didn't just say it in front of a room full of people. He said it when you and I had coffee with him or we were traveling on a bus or whatever. So, again, I think that is a great, great move by the Browns.
Yeah, good man, and a sign that good things happen to good people. You go about the durability there, Jeff. I go back to working on stage with Jim Kelly, the great Buffalo Bills quarterback, a couple of years back. And he said a player's best ability is his availability. And that's not going to be something that we can assign to Ravens cornerback Tavon Young, who tore his ACL in recent OTAs with the Baltimore Ravens. John Harbaugh says there wasn't much contact, just bumped into another player. Now the Ravens are without a guy who started 11 games as a rookie, Jeff, and who started to turn some heads. I mean, this is a contact sport. This is a dangerous sport, even when you're kind of dialing them back a little bit in the off-season, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, last year it was almost alarming the number of injuries that occurred during these OTAs and coaching sessions and all that. And I found it fascinating. I don't know if you saw the thing. Adam Gase has really scaled back what they're doing on the field at speed in Miami because of that very thing. You can't afford to lose a guy in practice. And so here's the deal. We're doing the same thing right now. We're in training camp. We bring in 17 defensive backs. We're in day 4 or 5. You get in training camp, you don't know what day it is. But we've lost, of those 17, we've lost 8 of them to soft tissue injuries. Well, you think, well, I mean, that paralyzes your football team. Mm. And, you know, that's the life we live. And managing risk, I guess is the way you say it, is, you know, becoming more and more important.
Mm. Bears wide receiver Cameron Meredith, he was their leading receiver last year. He's out with a thumb injury. He's not going to be back on the field until training camps open at the end of July. And let's just finish up, Jeff, with this whole voluntary OTAs, which what they are at the moment at this stage, so much being made about the fact that Odell Beckham Jr. is not in these OTAs with the New York Giants. They are voluntary. The stories are not really about Odell's physical condition. We know for a fact, and I know for a fact, seeing him, there are very few who work as hard as Odell Beckham Jr. off the field, so he's not going to come in out of shape. But this has been quite the story in New York, and I get the sense that we won't see Odell until mandatory minicamps in mid-June. What are your thoughts on Odell's absence? Because while they're voluntary, they're not really voluntary, are they?
Well, you know, by rule, they are. By Players Association rule, by NFL rule, they are. Hmm. However, what these things are about, as much as the football part of it, it's the chemistry part of it, it's the developing the culture inside the locker room part of it. And this, you know, again, Neil, we've talked about this guy numerous times about, you know, what have been the headlines in the last month about him. It's about, you know, he's not at minicamp, he's not doing this, he signs a Nike deal that brings in more money than his Giants contract. And all of these things separate him from his teammates. And, you know, I'm really, really anxious to see how this whole thing is going to work, because you got Brandon Marshall coming over. He could be on the field right now with Brandon Marshall working together, because this is a team game and in that locker room. So, again, this is not in my mind, a positive sign.
Jeff, you mentioned there that, you know, as the rules stand, it is voluntary. And I think I'm sort of surprised that we don't see more star players stay away. And maybe this is something where when the NFL Players Association and the league sit down for the next collective bargaining agreement, they almost make them all mandatory as part of vital preparation for a season. Because I feel like what the Players Association are doing at the moment is toeing the line, and all the players are attending, but they never gave up anything at the bargaining table, the NFL owners, to get the players into the building, because these are clearly vital times when you're preparing a team and preparing the chemistry. So they do kind of need to be there, but he doesn't have to be there at the moment. I think here's where I would worry if I'm a Giants fan, is Odell's retweeting a lot of stuff which is being said about him not being there. And I'll give you an example. There's a radio journalist in New York called Roland Martin who tweeted Jeff last week. He said, "I'm sick of folks acting like star athletes must always do what a coach asks. McAdoo wants OBJ at workouts. See you when it's mandatory." And Odell Beckham retweeted that, Jeff. So it's almost like he's not only staying away, but he's taking shots at his bosses as well.
Yeah, again, it's all signs of a young kid who doesn't get it. And, he is really, to me, kind of an enigma. And you know this better than anybody, because you spent more time with him than anybody I know. And, he on one hand, there's this warm, wonderful, giving guy who spends time with people and all that other stuff. And then on the other side, there's this prima donna that needs attention and, is openly. When you do that, when you retweet something like that, you're being openly defiant in my mind, right? And so if that tweet had been come out and you saw it and you just let it go, that's all good. You can't control what somebody else says. But when you endorse that, what somebody else says, it's almost like you're saying to McAdoo, and I know how coaches think. You're saying to McAdoo, I'm bigger than you. I'll be there when I'm required by my contract to be there. Now, the Players Association will defend him on that and should defend him on that. But the reality of the game about winning, and right, Tom Brady will walk into the Hall of Fame. And this is, I don't know if you caught this, Neil. Tom Brady will walk into the Hall of Fame. I saw him at OTAs the other day on a little piece of footage I watched. And they were in a skelly drill on the goal line. And he throws a pass and scores a touchdown to a free agent running back. And he runs and grabs him. And they hug each other like they just won the Super Bowl. That's what winning is, right? That's what until they get that, until players and teams get that, it's a struggle.
And Tom Brady, even at this stage in his career, Jeff, if Bill Belichick says jump, Tom's going to ask how high and when do you want me to do it and how often do you want me to do it? That part has never changed. All of this Odell Beckham stuff comes against the backdrop of general manager Jerry Reese saying that it was time for him to grow up. And I think you're right. Odell has a real warmth to him. I've seen it so many times. He wants to be great. He wants to be a great role model to young players. He was so good at the Pro Bowl that the Giants received letters from fans and from the NFL saying what a great ambassador he was for the team, because he was brilliant at the Pro Bowl, and I saw it. But what the team want is what they kind of want from all their players on the field. But with Odell, they want that on and off the field. They want consistency, Jeff.
Yeah, and I think we got to always keep in mind that the main thing is the main thing. And in pro football, the main thing is winning. Right now, there's a lot of things that go into that equation, not just talented players and committed players. And, there's so many factors that enter into it. But what you hope you have, and this is, we talked about Christian Kirk, what you hope you have as a football team is your best players are your best workers, are your most committed team guys. And that, again, look at Tom Brady. Look at the teams that sustain greatness over time. That's the kind of chemistry or culture or whatever term you choose to use, that's the kind of culture that they develop.
We'll keep an eye on it. It seems like a story that's going to run and run. And in New York, they don't shy away from those kind of big stories.
A Oh, hey, I'm going to tell you something. Ain't no place to hide in the Big Apple.
No, absolutely not. All right, let's move on to our state of the franchise for this week then. We'll kick off with the Houston Texans. So they went 9-7 on the season. The third straight year of 9-7 for the Houston Texans. Seemed like the same old story as well. It was strong defense and some offensive issues. They lost J.J. Watt very early in the season, but defense was top-ranked in the NFL. Number one overall in terms of yards allowed. 12th against the run, second against the pass. But offense just didn't pan out with Brock Osweiler at quarterback. They were 29th overall, 8th in rushing, 29th in passing. And they finished losing to New England in the divisional round of the playoffs. We now know, Jeff, that the Brock Osweiler faux pas cost this team $21 million in cash and their first and second round picks in 2018. So that's going to put Rick Smith on the hot seat as a general manager, I would guess.
Yeah, you know what? Bob McNair, the owner of the Texans, is a guy that craves a Super Bowl. And he's willing, and he's shown it. He's put his cards on the table. He will do what it takes, or what he thinks it takes, to do that. They were quarterback deficient before they brought in Osweiler. He, you know, again, whoever decided or made that decision, whether whoever, there are some jobs on the line in Houston right now. There is such a small window of opportunity to win a Super Bowl. They have a defense, Neil, that is good enough to win the Super Bowl. They just need an offense that can give them a chance. And this team is very, very similar to, in my mind, to what the Broncos were on their Super Bowl run. They can be dominant on defense. They just need the offense to not screw it up. And, you know, it's really interesting as you watch the Texans. You know, as we evaluate this team, Neil, I think it's kind of one of those deals where you say, okay, let's look at this defense. Even though they had some of their best players out last year, they're outstanding. Now, you bring J.J. Watt back into the mix, they have a chance to be dominant on defense, whatever that is in this day and age. Yeah. Right? Because everybody's, you know, it's incredible. We had Jerry Glanville here as a guest coach for the first week of training camp, and the 1977 Falcons, you know, think about this. When Jerry was the defensive coordinator in Atlanta, they gave up 9.2 points a game over the entire season, which is an NFL record that still stands. Better than the Bears, better than 85 Bears, and, you know, the Ravens in 2001, all these great defense, Steelers in 76. And you know what their record was? 7-7, and they didn't go to the playoffs.
Wow.
Because the offense couldn't. They were inept, and that's kind of the situation that Houston's in.
Well, how did Jerry do with all the new rules against defenses? You can't do this and you can't do that, Jeff.
I'm going to tell you something. I really wish that we were able to do this yesterday when he was here, because I said, Jerry, you got to get it. Was priceless. Those days with him were incredible, and you know he looks at it and goes, it's like, I won't even use the language you use, but, you know, it's turned into, you know, the game in his mind is soft. And we looked at some of the old Oilers tape and Falcon tape, and the game was played in an entirely different way at that time.
All right, Jeff, let's move on. Let's look at the offense of the Houston Texans then. So Bill O'Brien has already said that Deshaun Watson is gaining ground and progressing nicely, and we know Tom Savage is likely to be the starter, but do you really see Tom Savage being the starter on opening day, or is there going to be too much pressure to get Deshaun Watson in there?
Well, I think, you know, again, when you look at it, I think it's almost like there are two schools of thought. You got to know, that, you know, when Mr. McNair is desperate for a Super Bowl, and Rick Smith is desperate to prove that the Osweiler mistake was a one-off. And so there will be a lot of pressure for Watson to be on the field, because he's the hope for the future. He's the hope for the Super Bowl. However, from the coaching standpoint, you know, you're always going to, typically, you're always going to go to the point of, you know, risk versus reward. There is a huge risk to put a player on the field, particularly at quarterback, before he's ready to play. And I think that is the dilemma that they face. Now, what makes it even harder, Neil, is how do you get him enough reps in game situations to make that call? Because training camp is one thing. I mean, he'll get the offense. He's a smart kid. He'll understand the concepts, all of it. But there's a tremendous difference of the speed of the game and what you see between practice, preseason, and then when the real games come, it's a whole other deal. So Tom Savage has at least played a little bit in the National Football League. I think personally that Savage will be the starter early, and then Watson will take the job as they go forward.
And I guess if Savage can avoid the turnovers which plagued Brock Osweiler, then there are some players to work with, Jeff. Lamar Miller is a very productive running back. DeAndre Hopkins, you know, we had Steve Smith Sr. over here a couple of months ago, and he was saying that DeAndre Hopkins, for him, is one of the top three or four receivers in the entire league. He just hasn't had the quarterback to throw him the passes. You got Will Fuller at wide receiver. Braxton Miller potentially could come along. And, you know, they're growing at tight end. They like to use their tight ends a lot, C.J. Fedorowicz and Ryan Griffin. So you've got to kind of like some of the skill position players, haven't you?
No question. I mean, this is a good football team. You look at that roster top to bottom, and they've got football players at every level. And I'm talking about, when you look at a football team, you're talking about the levels of a football team. Defensively, it's the front linebackers in the secondary. Same thing offensively. It's the offensive line, it's the quarterback, it's the running back, it's the receiver. You look at them as a group, as a collective, and you don't see, other than the maybe the most critical position, which is quarterback, you don't see deficiencies in this roster anymore. They have built a good football team. Now they just need a captain to steer the ship.
Finishing up with the Houston Texans, Jeff, 3 straight 9-7 seasons. Is Bill O'Brien a very, very average coach, or has he done well with what he's had to work with in his time there?
You know, it's been interesting. You know, he's faced a tremendous amount of adversity in his time at Houston. And, you know, in our business, in pro football, you talk about all the time that you can expect 3 lightning bolts during the course of a season. You know, something that is really, really problematic. Player injury, somebody getting arrested off the field. I mean, there's always something. But he has handled, in my mind, these kinds of things in an extremely good fashion. Now, the bottom line in our business, however, is the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And if you don't win, and don't win at the highest level, you're in jeopardy. I mean, that's just our business. So I think there are a lot of people in Houston that recognize the window to a Super Bowl is open, but it doesn't stay open long.
That number one defense took a hit in the offseason. They lost A.J. Bouye at cornerbacks, Quinton Demps at safety, and John Simon at outside linebacker. Jeff, is this an arrow up, arrow down, or arrow sideways team?
But you know what? They may be one of the hardest teams to define that way, because there's so many questions. You know, you look at the defense, and yes, they did lose some guys in the second level, but they're gaining some guys back, including the best, if he can come back at the level he was, maybe the best front seven player in the NFL, and a huge emotional leader to their football team. So I think they're a team that really, really, really is, they will either go, when I say this, you look at them and you say, this is a team that has the potential to be 12-4. And this is also a team that has the potential to struggle. Mm-hmm. And it all comes down to what they get from the quarterback position.
All right, let's move on to the Seattle Seahawks. They went 10-5-1 a year ago. That was good enough to take the AFC West. They lost in the divisional round of the playoffs to the Atlanta Falcons. Their offense was 12th. In the NFL, 25th in rushing, a marked change from those days of Marshawn Lynch. They were 10th in passing, Defense was a top five defense again. Fifth overall, seventh against the run, eighth against the pass. But Jeff, before we get into the actual roster, I want to address a story that was doing the rounds last week. Came from Seth Wickersham of ESPN, and he paints this picture of a team in turmoil, of a locker room divided, and talks about Richard Sherman not being able to let go of the interception in Super Bowl 49 27 months ago. Only last year we saw Sherman go after offensive coordinator Daryl Bevel on the sideline when the Seahawks passed down near the goal line against the Rams on Thursday Night Football. If that story is to be believed, Jeff, Russell Wilson didn't just throw the ball to Malcolm Butler at the end of that Super Bowl. He threw a permanent divide between the offense and the defense. And we've seen open talk of trading Richard Sherman this offseason, which didn't pan out. I mean, there's sometimes, as a journalist, you always say, well, there's no smoke without fire. I mean, the Seahawks did refute the story, but, you know, I don't know. This is a respected and renowned writer for ESPN who went into some detail there and actually spoke to Pete Carroll for the story. It just makes you wonder what's going on behind the scenes there in Seattle.
All right. Let me give you my take. After talking to Maurice Kelly, who's the assistant GM,
yeah,
a very, very ex-player of mine, a very, very close friend of mine. We just had a conversation this week about that very thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about Michael Bennett. And this is my impression, right? Pete wants his players to have their personality. He gives them an opportunity to speak. He wants them to become, he wants them out there. He understands how this works. See, we don't, as fans or journalists or, you know, outsiders, which we all are,
mm-hmm,
to the Seahawks, we have a perception of what is inside. And like Michael Bennett, we have a perception of guys like that because they are out there and they will say what they think. Now, there's not a single one of us who has ever, in my mind, that I've ever met, is 100% happy with everything that goes on in the organization. And, you know, we all have frustration in our job. The difference is Pete doesn't silence those guys. And he, you know, that's the locker room, that's the environment, that's the culture that he's created. On the other hand, you got places like New England where you can't get anything out of it. Right? There's a lot of ways to do it. And again, this is a product of the culture that's in Seattle. And I think if you, after talking to Maurice, if you were in that locker room, you would realize that this is natural in football teams, natural in team environments. Shoot, it's natural in business. And the difference is when Richard Sherman says something in the media, it immediately becomes a bigger story than it probably is. When Michael Bennett says something in the media, it becomes a huge story. And so in this media age, I think there's a tendency to overblow these things. And I think, personally, I think it's overblown.
So, Jeff, if it's overblown, but if there is any kind of divide in that locker room, as a coach who's worked on all of the levels in more than 30 years, is it more survivable because it's offense against defense? Would this be more of a problem if there was a problem between Russell Wilson and Doug Baldwin? And we saw in the story there was a lot of open challenging of Russell Wilson by the defense because, of course, offense is competing on the practice field against defense. I'm thinking back to the 85 Bears, which was essentially two separate teams. The offense chaired Mike Ditka off the field and the defense had Buddy Ryan up on their shoulders. I mean, is it survivable and is it sort of sustainable? Because this is a team that's won at least 10 games and gone to the playoffs in each of the last 5 years. So,
yeah, is it survivable? Yeah, it's survivable. Then the 85 Bears may be as good an example of that as any team in the history of the National Football League. You had a head coach who didn't like the defensive coordinator, actually almost came to blows in that game in Miami at halftime when, you know, the Bears had a chance to have that perfect season, and they went down there, and because of the defense's stubbornness about handling a certain, and I can't get into the X and O part of it, basically Miami comes out in a formation, personnel group that they don't adjust to, and the Bears just keep doing what they do on defense, and they lose that game, and Ditka and Ryan almost get the blows in the locker room. Teams are amazingly resilient if they're talented enough. Mm. So this football team is a byproduct, again, of the culture that they create in Seattle. What's important in Seattle? You talk of the, if you know anything about the Seahawks, it's about compete every day. Mm. They compete in every drill, every day. And again, so when you create that competitive environment and then give the players the freedom to say what they think, you can understand how from the outside it can look like it's in chaos. I don't believe that is the case in Seattle.
All right, let's dig into the roster a little bit then, because it is a hugely successful team. They won Super Bowl 48. They were in Super Bowl 49. They, as I said, they've been regulars to the playoffs. But maybe if we didn't focus so much on the infighting, Jeff, or perceived infighting, we would be screaming for them to put an offensive line in front of Russell Wilson, because he's been beaten up the last couple of years. Last year we saw him sacked. Well, he's been sacked to NFL high 86 times over the past two seasons. Last year he suffered an ankle, knee and chest injuries. He didn't miss any time, but it did affect the way he played. I remember seeing huge bandages around his ankles. And yeah, this is one of the more mobile quarterbacks in the NFL who's been dropped more than any quarterback in the NFL over the past two seasons. That's a good place to start if we're going to nitpick with the Seahawks.
Well, you make a fabulous point, Neil, that we're not talking about Joe Namath at the end of his career. I don't know how many years. Or Dan Marino, if you remember the last years of Marino's career.
Right.
Guys that can't get out of the way anymore. They can't move, right? This is one of the better athletes at that position in the National Football League, and he's being sacked more than anybody else. I mean, he's a rabbit back there. When I talk to the Patriot coaches about their plan against Russell Wilson, the whole thing was to keep him in the pocket, keep him contained, because he makes plays outside the pocket better than he makes plays in the pocket. Mm. So, again, you're talking about a special, special guy, and he's been hit and sacked more than anybody else. That's where, in my mind, the deficiency lies in Seattle. So as you look at this football team, Neil, these kinds of things, highly competitive defense that is good enough to win a Super Bowl, mm-hmm. and when you're with Houston, it's kind of interesting because they're the same kind of team. The offense has just got to not screw it up. Run the football and manage the clock and do all of those things. What I don't get about the Seahawks is, when they were very, very good, they could pound the ball at you. And they now seem to be heading into a new world on their offense. I know they want to diversify more. I know they want to be more of a multiple team. When you're at your best, you're doing what you do best. And this team, in my mind, is starting to, I don't know if because they want to make it Russell's team or what it is, but the focus that they had when they were really good, when they won the Super Bowl and then went back the next year, was first and foremost, pound the ball, be physical, all of those things. And, I think they got to refine that identity.
Yeah, 25th in rushing, Jeff, top 10 passing attack. But if we go back to the playoff game last year against Detroit, suddenly that was the Seahawks that you're talking about. Thomas Rawls went for over 200 yards on the day, didn't he? But it didn't happen the following week in Atlanta. And that's where I think it's the key, is to get back to that. And whether it's Rawls or an in-shape Eddie Lacy or a combination of those two and CJ Procise, you feel like that's still your best opportunity with play action and hitting Jimmy Graham down the seams and all of that. Just because it's about an identity, isn't it? Then you've got a real identity, which is what the Seahawks are.
Exactly. And see, this is how fragile a locker room is. When I say a locker room, I'm talking about your football team. This is how fragile it is. These are highly competitive guys. All right? And so on defense, they know that they're good enough to win. And when the offense, when you see your quarterback back and all that, and then you look at how Wilson has become kind of a, not a media guy, but kind of a, you know, his profile has been raised in the last 3 years beyond what it was when he was rookie. And so now they talk about it's Russell's team. But you got to understand those guys on the other side of the room, the defensive guys, who are some of the best in the National Football League, it's really easy to let jealousy creep into your locker room. And let me tell you something. If you're wearing green, and that's the color of jealousy, that's the wrong color no matter what your team is.
It's, when you look at soccer teams, Jeff, in the Premier League, they always used to say that you build a team right down the middle in your backbone. You get a good goalkeeper, you get a good centre-back, a good centre-midfielder and a good striker. And I look at the Seahawks defence and right down the middle, they got Michael Bennett, arguably the best defensive lineman in the NFL. Bobby Wagner, who I would actually say is potentially the best player on this entire team and certainly one of the best in the NFL. And you've got Earl Thomas at safety, roaming the field. I mean, talk about a defensive backbone, providing they get Earl Thomas back, Jeff, because they really missed him, didn't they, last year?
Yeah, and you know, that's really a common theme because you talk to baseball guys, and they say you need to be good down the middle. You need a great pitcher, you need a great catcher, and you need a great center fielder. The same is true in every sport. And so when you look at the Seahawks, you know, and their defense in particular, This is a defense that has not just good players. You're talking about great players at every level of that defense. You mentioned those three guys right down the middle, and then you factor in Richard Sherman outside, who, love him or hate him, he's one of the best players at his position in the National Football League.
Yep.
And you're talking about an elite-level defense. You know, the bottom line is the bottom line. And if you are not a football team, if they don't get that offensive line thing straightened out, it's going to always be, you know, frustrating in Seattle because they have the kind of defense that should not win one Super Bowl, but multiple Super Bowls.
Yeah, I think that's probably where, if there is any truth to that story, that's where the frustration came from because Sherman probably feels they did throw one away, literally, quite literally throw one away, but maybe that's where they haven't been able to move on. Jeff, as we look arrow up, arrow down, sideways, you know, I, as a journalist, I love all the stories and the, you know, the fact that this is a team that always speaks its mind and always is in the news, but I'm not down on the Seahawks. If I was to give an arrow, it would be up. I think I have concerns about the offensive line, but if you told me now the Seahawks are going to be in the Super Bowl this coming year, I wouldn't think you were crazy. This is a team that is there or thereabouts year in and year out. What are you thinking, up, down, or sideways?
I agree with you. With the one exception, Neil, that, you know, this is a show-me business. This is a prove-it-to-me business. And you look at this football team, and there are still some questions about it. You know, the questions about the Seahawks used to be, you know, about the receiving, right? And then, you know, Doug Baldwin comes in with the offense, and he, you know, so all of a sudden, that's not a question anymore. Now the question is about their chemistry from the outside, right? And also about whether they're good enough on the offensive line to win a Super Bowl. This could be a Super Bowl team. However, it can also be a team that, you know, is a wild card entry into the playoffs because they're in a very, very tough division.
All right, let's move on to our final team this week, the Kansas City Chiefs. They went 12-4 a year ago. They lost disappointingly at home to Pittsburgh in the AFC divisional round. The offense was 20th, 15th in rushing, 19th in passing. Defense was 24th, 26th against the run, 18th against the pass. But that was very, very deceptive because this was a defense that prided itself on turning the football over. Jeff, as we start with the Chiefs, who are loaded with star names, and this year they'll play 6 primetime games, more than any other NFL team. So the league clearly likes the Kansas City Chiefs. But as we look at this team, for a number of years, they've had last 8 written all over them. but they've never looked like they're going to approach greatness. That's got to be a frustration for this team, for the fans of the Chiefs. They're kind of, like I just said with Seattle, they're there or thereabouts, but we've never seen them sort of make a deep run. We've never seen that sort of flirting with this is their year. We've never had that kind of belief that they're on a special mission. There's just something not quite right or not quite complete. What do you think?
You know, I get a lot of film in the offseason on this team. And, you know, if you watch them, I think Andy Reid, and this is me as a football coach saying it, there are a lot of guys that have reputations of being offensive geniuses and, you know, da da da. When you watch them on offense, the things that they do, the formations that they use, the diversity in their offense, all of it is really, really good. And you look at that offense and you see, you know, a Travis Kelce, and you see dynamic players, guys that can make big plays, and an offensive line, you know, that's tough. It's not a great pass-blocking line, particularly Fisher, but as a football team offensively, I think they're a really, really good football team. Now, you talk about the defense, and, you know, Bobby Sutton, the defensive coordinator, is a guy that believes in, they'll give up yards, but gosh almighty, do they make big plays when they need to make big plays. And you think about I think it was the Falcons game last year, where they make a huge play when the game's just about to turn the other way. And so, you know, again, this is a team that really, you almost wonder if they're not cursed in some way, because I go back to my time when I was in Kansas City in 2001, and they were starting to assemble what was a really, really good football team. Priest Holmes, you know, all of those, Tony Gonzalez, you know, all of those, Trent Green, all of those guys. And you would have thought that they would make a deep playoff run, and they never did. They never were able to get it done. So maybe the curse of Hank Stram is upon the Chiefs.
Yeah, it makes you wonder. So what is needed to take the next step then, Jeff? Because you know I'm a big Alex Smith guy. I felt he was hard done by in San Francisco. I think he's more athletic than people give him credit for. I think he can help a team move the chains. But this team gave up a lot to go and get Pat Mahomes in the first round. The clock is ticking, surely, on Alex Smith's exit from Kansas City. Do the Chiefs feel that the quarterback position is the only thing stopping them reaching the next level? What are your thoughts?
You know, I don't know how some of this stuff gets out there. You know, I say to my players here that the easiest thing in pro football is to get labeled.
Yep.
One of the hardest things in pro football is to get that label off of you. So when he was in San Francisco, he got labeled as this guy, right? And all I would say to the fans is put the tape on and watch closely. Alex Smith is an upper end of the spectrum quarterback in the National Football League.
Agreed.
And I think that people don't, he may be the most underappreciated talent in the league. So, you know, it's a tough, tough deal. But here's the reality. Until you do it, until you win, until you make a deep run, like you said, you'll always be that guy.
Mm. He has weapons around him, certainly does have, I mean, when Jeremy Maclin was healthy, he can stretch the field. Tyreek Hill can score from anywhere on the field. And you mentioned Travis Kelce already, Jeff, in terms of that. I think run after the catch is something that's so special with Kelce. He's not quite Gronk, but he's not a million miles away, is he? I mean, what do you think of these skill position players?
You know what? That is amazing you bring up Kelce, because when I watch the tape, and I watch all of the things that they do with him, right? I mean, watching play after play after play after play of the things that that guy can do. And this is a big, big statement I'm going to make. But in some ways, he's Gronk. Mm-hmm. I won't say he's better than Gronk, but in some ways, he's Gronk. Because you watch him, Neil, on tape, and he'll block, which most tight ends today don't want to do. He has the ability to split out wide and catch the football. They run bubble screens, which is like unheard of in the league. Mm. Right? He's that athletic. So in my mind, he is one of the elite players at his position in the league. Now, you brought up Hill. Again, same thing. Now, I'm not ready to say he's an elite player at his position, but I'm going to tell you, he has elite skills in terms of making big plays. Mm. And if they can get Macklin back, and, you know, so I think this is a really, really good Chiefs team.
On defense, Justin Houston just couldn't get healthy, Jeff. He came back and dominated in a game against Denver, but he was never right all season as he came back from serious injury. You've got Dee Ford, who had over 10 sacks rushing from the outside. Derek Johnson should come back at inside linebacker. Ramique Wilson came on last year in Johnson's absence at inside linebacker. Then you've got Marcus Peters, Eric Berry. I mean, there's two again right there. You don't want to use the E word too often, but you've got to say, well, if they're among the best in their positions in the NFL, they are elite players. And I think Peters and Berry, we've probably got to put them in that category, haven't we? I mean, again, you talk about star power. It's all right there for the Chiefs for the taking.
It absolutely is. And if Houston can come back and play an entire season, and we talked about that consistency and availability issue, which is what's really important. That separates the great ones from the superstars. Then you look at this football team and say, where are they deficient? I mean, where are the holes? And defensively, you know, you've got elite level pass rushers. You've got two, and I agree with you about Berry. Berry is unbelievable at his, I mean, what he's done in his career is phenomenal. Had that kid been in New York or Dallas or LA or in any of the major media markets, I mean, he would be a household name. I mean, this guy comes back from leukemia to be one of the best players in the league. I mean, it's a phenomenal, phenomenal story. They take a chance on the corner. I mean, that was he got kicked off of his college team. Mm-hmm. And the coaches at Washington said, don't touch him with a 10-foot pole. And they took a chance, and so far, the returns have been huge. So you look at the team and you say, this is a team, in my opinion, that has a chance to go to the Super Bowl. Their special teams are as the best in the National Football League. Not good, Neil. The best in the National Football League. You look at them, and they are a weapon. You remember a couple years ago, they go to Houston for a playoff game, and the first play of the game was a 90-yard kickoff return for a touchdown. That's how dynamic their special teams are.
Jeff, there are a few times when I go around training camps that, you know, I see hundreds and hundreds of players, but there are a few where I think I'll always remember the first time I sort of saw them in action. And one of them was Julian Edelman as a rookie with the New England Patriots. And I was watching him run around and I was like, who is this guy? He literally looks like a Wes Welker clone. I went down the roster and I remember writing about him that night in my training camp blog about this undrafted or seventh round, whatever he was, you know, guy out of Kent State. He's a Wes Welker clone. I remember the first time I saw Khalil Mack on the field, I felt like he'd been shot out of a cannon. And I can distinctly remember the first time I saw Marcus Peters on the practice field with the Chiefs. And they just moved inside. There was a tornado warning in training camps. So they'd moved into the indoor building and they were running team drills. And he picked off Alex Smith twice. And I was like, but Alex Smith doesn't throw many interceptions. This guy must really have a nose for the football. It's not often those kind of things really strike you the first time you see them and they pan out. But that's exactly what Marcus Peters has been, a real ball hawk.
You know what? I got to take a second here because you just cut my heart out. Cut my heart out.
Whoa.
Because you could recognize in one practice that Edelman was as good as he is. And when I was at Hawaii, his junior college coach called me and said, I got a guy for you. And I said, okay, Larry, tell me about it. He goes, it's our quarterback, Julian Edelman. And he said, I don't think he's a quarterback at the next level, but I think he's a good enough athlete, right? And I looked at the kid and I said, yeah, he's a heck of a player, competitive, all that stuff. What does he play? And I turned him down. So I didn't recognize Julian Edelman. And you go to one practice and he's the next Wes Welker. So maybe we ought to bring you in to evaluate personnel.
Well, maybe we should have the all Jeff missed team. So we've got Julian Edelman at wide receiver, Jay Ajayi at running back. Who's going to be at quarterback?
I'm going to tell you what. Don't even go there because there's a long list of guys. You know, I said, Danny Amendola, I turned him down. I didn't think he ran well enough.
Jeff.
But I will say, let me wait before that. You know, you got to have all
yourself.
The yes. Michael Bennett, I'll take that one.
Right? Yep.
So again, you know, but that's kind of the fun thing of this whole deal. You never know.
Jeff.
You never really know.
You and I are going to sit in a bar late one night at the Super Bowl with a napkin in front of us, and we're going to make that team up, and no one else will know, just you and me, and a table full of empty beer glasses. What do you say?
I'm in.
All right,
I'm
so in. Just finishing up on the Chiefs then. I mentioned Alex Smith, that, you know, the perception is good but not great to go to the next level, and I think the perception for Andy Reid as the coach, Jeff, has been the same way throughout his career. Good, but can't get you to the next level. You think of all his Philadelphia Eagles teams. But in the same way that Alex Smith would have him queuing up around the block if he was hit the streets tomorrow, I think it's the same with Andy Reid. What do you make of Andy Reid as a head coach and the job he's done in Kansas City?
Well, you know, that is a really, really good question that we could chew on for 3 episodes of this. You know, perception is reality, they say. Mm. Well, the perception about Andy and the perception about the Chiefs is that they underachieve. Well, where does that come from? That comes from the fact that we evaluate based upon Super Bowls. And that's okay, because that's the world we live in. That's what we sign up for in this business. Now, I will tell you, as a football coach watching another football team and doing the evaluation, I think they are extremely well coached. Mm. There are issues, I think, if you look at it historically, clock management, some of those kind of things, you may be able to call into question, but schematically and the ability to put a roster together and all of those things, I think he's proven he can do that. But it's interesting because you say you measure greatness in coaches by how many Super Bowls they won.
Mm.
Well, you know, you look at guys like, I think Mike Ditka is a good coach. You talk about greatness. Now, he won one Super Bowl in Chicago. That already elevates him above everybody else. But then he went to New Orleans, same guy, you know, and it didn't happen. So it's such a fickle, fickle business. Mm.
Arrow up, down, or sideways, Jeff? I still like the look of this team.
I think the arrow is up. Here's where I see Kansas City having challenges, if they have challenges. This is not a team. This is not an offense. This is not a quarterback, frankly, that's great playing from behind. They need to manage the clock. They need to manage. Well, I say manage. I'm not talking about you got to run the ball. You know, it's about playing complementary football. And this team, when they're good, when they're really humming, the defense is turning it over. They're giving up yards, but they're turning it over. The special teams create great field position, and the offense doesn't turn it over. And they're not a down the field throwing team, but when you watch them, they do an awful lot of very, very creative things offensively. I just don't know if this team gets in a game where they have to score 35, dropping back on it. That's where I don't.
All right, Jeff, we're going to finish up real quick to let you get off to the practice field. I've got a couple of questions from the mailbag. The first one comes from Andy, who says, do you think the new international practice squad slots will build the game overseas, or is it just a gimmick? So we know there's 4 players that have headed off to the teams of the NFC South, Jeff. 3 of them are Brits. All I would say is, I'll let you answer this one, is you coaches don't go into having gimmicks on the field, do you?
No, but in the end, you know, we're measured by whether you win or lose, right? Here, this is really one that's very close to our heart. I won't say my heart, but you lived through this before.
Yep.
This is almost like as Yogi Berra said, deja vu all over again. What I hope the National Football League and everybody involved in this venture understands is that know your history. Go back to the time when we had 16 international players in training camp, right? And what if you don't, this opportunity is so critical and so vital in terms of developing players around the globe, because it's about creating a pathway, a perception that you can get there. Now, you look at guys like Menelik, and I had a conversation with Menelik Watson the other day. You look at guys like Menelik, Jack Crawford, you know, now you can start to see it. Now, how we handle it, how we manage it, how we publicize it is really, really important. And I sent a note to those kids about how important it is that they understand this is a phenomenal opportunity. But you represent now way more than just you. Mm. You're every kid internationally. So you look at, there's a skinny little quarterback playing for the Kent XFL. He's got a chance to be a really good football player. and I'm serious. And you watch and you think, he might be one day, right? And so all of this is, there's nothing but good about it if we take advantage of the opportunity.
Well, yeah, that's the part that I think helps build the game, Jeff. That was part of the question. Will it build the game overseas? And I think it's giving young players and young athletes just that opportunity to dream and keep chasing that goal, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know what? If you go back, Neil, to when we first started that thing, right? When we first started the first incarnation of, you know, the international program, there was nobody. I mean, we were selling dreams 2-for-1. Mm. I mean, I remember sitting down in Sebastian Bulmer's living room with his junior coach because his parents were they didn't speak very good. They didn't have any confidence in their English, and trying to get them to understand that their 6'6" tall, skinny kid might one day have an opportunity to play in the national football. You would have thought I was selling, you know, it's almost like they looked at me like, wait, why are we wasting our time with this? This is so, there's no chance. Well, how many years did he play? How many Super Bowls did he win?
Mm-hmm.
So, but we have never taken advantage, in my opinion, to the level that we need to, all of it that's out there, so that young, there's another one out there. I can't tell you where he is, and there's more than one.
Mm.
I can't tell you where they are, but they're out there. And not only do we have to find them, but we have to continue to promote these guys, because that's the pathway. That you can't, I mean, it's almost unbelievable to me that when you look back and you think about it, that Sebastian did what he did, because there was nobody else. He was a true trailblazer. There was nobody who had done that.
No, that's a good place to end, Jeff, on that positive note, because I'm sure there are more out there, and we hope to find them in the coming months and years and have more of those players going off to the NFL. This has been Inside the Huddle in association with NFL Shop Europe and DraftKings.co.uk. Off to the practice field, Coach.
Yeah, and I'm going to tell you what, it's a good thing this thing's ending, because between practice and this podcast, I may not have a voice by 10:30.
All right. Well, I've probably done your players a service then, because you can't scream and shout at them. So just one more thing from you. Until next week, say goodbye to the good folks.
Aloha.